We're all right?
Good to go.
Okay. Thank you. I have the thumbs up from over there, which means that we can get going. All right. Good morning, everyone. My name is David Nahai, and I serve as chair of the Los Angeles Regional Water Quality Control Board. Today is Thursday, April 24th, and the time is 8:59 a.m. And I'd like to call this meeting to order. For people who only want to listen or to watch the meeting, the board's customary webcast is available. There is a direct link to the webcast on the meeting agenda posted on our website. In addition, we're receiving presentations and public comments through a Zoom meeting platform and in person. For people who want to listen or watch the meeting in Spanish, we have Spanish interpretation services available through the Zoom platform. Instructions are shown on the slide. And I'm to ask one of our Spanish interpreters, please, to explain how to participate in Spanish. Thank you so much.
Buenos días a todos. Tenemos interpretación disponible en esta sesión. En la parte de atrás tenemos dispositivos para las personas que se encuentran presentes para escuchar la interpretación en vivo. Y también, si están ustedes tomando parte de esta reunión por Zoom, ustedes pueden ir a la parte inferior de la pantalla. Hay un icono de un globito terráqueo. Ustedes pueden seleccionar, apretar el canal de español y listo. Thank you. Back to you, Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Please note that for all Los Angeles Regional Water Quality Control meetings, there is no expectation of privacy regarding any communications. Meetings are recorded and names of participants are listed in the Zoom forum. Participation in a recorded meeting will be deemed consent to be recorded. And with that, we will start with our introductory items, and could we first have the roll call? Ms. Rowe?
Yes. Vice Chair Ashion?
Present.
Board Member Camacho?
Here.
Board Member Christensen?
Here.
Board Member Mendez?
Here.
Chair Nahai?
Yes.
Roll call completed. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, to the order of the agenda, note that the agenda items are numbered for identification purposes only and may not necessarily be considered in this order. I'll ask the EO if there are any changes to the order of the agenda.
Chair, there are no changes to the order.
Thank
you. Thank you.
All right. Next, we will deal with the approval of draft meeting minutes for the March 27th, 2025 meeting. This is our item three. We'll move on adoption of the draft meeting minutes for the March 27th meeting. Let me ask if there are any changes to the draft minutes. We've received them. Okay. Could I ask for a motion to approve?
Move approval.
From Board Member Camacho?
I'll second.
And a second from Vice Chair Ashion. Could we have a roll call vote, please?
Vice Chair Ashion?
Yes.
Board Member Camacho?
Yes.
Board Member Christensen?
Abstain.
Board Member Mendez?
Yes.
Chair Nahai?
Yes.
Motion carries. Thank you.
All right. Next, we'll move to item four on the agenda, which are board member communications. First, I will ask if there are any ex parte disclosures by board members. Please identify any discussions that you may have had requiring disclosure pursuant to Government Code Section 11430.40. Are there any ex parte communication disclosures? I'll start with board member.
None to report.
Vice Chair Ashton?
None to report.
None to report.
Thank you.
None.
All right. I have none to report. We will move on then to board member reports. Anything that any of the board members would like to share? Start with you, Board Member Mendez.
Nothing at this moment. Thank you.
Vice Chair Ashton?
I have a lot. I'm sorry.
Okay.
It was a busy month. First, I want to say Happy Earth Month to everyone. I hope that everyone is able to participate in some of the activities that have been going on around our city and county. Thank you to the NGOs and community-based organizations and the electeds and government entities who have been putting on events. They've been really interesting and impactful, so hopefully you're able to attend some of those. I participated very briefly in the Cal EPA Earth Day celebration up in in Sacramento on Tuesday, and they put on a number of really wonderful events for family that were educational, got to meet the water board staff who do outreach and engagement up in Sacramento, so that was nice. I also had the opportunity this month to tour the Alondra Park stormwater project, which I believe that our executive officer might mention in the report. Okay, so that was a really exciting project that's taking place in Los Angeles that I hope you all will check out when it opens shortly. Next, I wanted to mention that next week is the Environmental Law Institute's West Coast Boot Camp. That is for new environmental law practitioners or people that are interested in environmental law. There is a session on water law. I'm teaching a session on environmental justice. If you're interested in attending any of it, it's 3 days long, but there are a ton of different sessions that you can come and go from. It's next Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. I'm happy to give you information on that. Sorry, I have like three more things. The next thing I wanted to mention is last week we had our Santa Monica Bay Restoration Commission meeting. I sit on that commission in my role here as the representative for this board. And I just wanted to share a difficult conversation and vote that we had with regard to modifying the language that's in our current work plan so that it would comply with the new federal administration guidelines. And I wanted to explain what that is. So basically, we were modifying language such as climate change to make it compatible with new federal ideas about using extreme weather events, changing language such as DACs, which are disadvantaged communities, to the actual definitions that we draw those from, like the CalEnviro screen or the Water Code definitions for environmentally burdened communities. And we had a very long conversation about, you know, the need to change this in order to make sure that we could receive the grant funding for the critical projects that are so important for especially our most environmentally burdened communities. So in my vote and sort of how, you know, I thought of this is that we really want to ensure that we can get this grant funding so that we can do the critical projects that are needed. I come from this work from the Central Valley, where I worked on environmental justice and water issues, and I worked with communities in an environmental justice task force who literally did not have clean, safe, affordable drinking water. Communities like Tombstone in the middle of the Central Valley, where they had to make the difficult decision of using water that was contaminated and that they knew would make them sick instead of having no water. So I don't want to be in a situation where we are losing funding for the most vulnerable. So I encourage, if people have not watched and want to watch, to hear the comments that were made by many of the other organizations and entities who sit on the commission with regard to making sure that we are able to protect and preserve water quality for our most vulnerable. The last or second to last thing I want to mention is in stepping into the role as vice chair, I recently did a tribal training, which I would highly encourage if anyone has the opportunity to do. It was really well executed, I thought. And I don't know if it's available to the public. I'll find that out and maybe come back at the next meeting. But I really thought that it was very well done. And then my final thing is I wanted to just acknowledge that today is Armenian Genocide Remembrance Day. And as the granddaughter of Armenian Genocide survivors, I just wanted to take a moment to acknowledge that history. And I also believe that this week might be Holocaust Remembrance Day. So just to memorialize and honor the history of those who we lost and ensure that it never happens again. So thank you all. Looking forward to the meeting. Sorry for a long set of comments.
No, thank you. Thanks for sharing, really. Okay. Board Member Christensen.
Yeah, thank you so much. Indeed, happy Earth Month. And Board Member, or Vice Chair, I should say, Ashian. Thinking about your comments around having to change the language to get grant funding, this is something that so many organizations are having to consider. And I'm sure if you're involved with any nonprofits, you probably heard the rumors that were swirling around last week about there being a potential executive order to rescind 501c3 status for nonprofits that are working on climate and the environment. Luckily, the White House has come forward and said they're not actually considering any such executive order. However, it's probably not that far off that they would consider something like that, that this administration would consider something like that. So I just want to say I completely support being able to get good work done. Who cares what kind of language we use if we have to jump through a couple of hoops to make sure that we don't completely stall out over these next several years. I'm in support of that, and you know, let the record show that climate change is real. Science agrees that it's real and that it is driven by human activity, and that each of us has to act. And so during this Earth Month, while I know it seems like this is an intractable giant problem that no one individual can actually have an effect on, and that's true, no one individual can solve it. However, each of us gets to vote with our wallet in the products that we buy, just in our daily lives, taking time to sort of look into your options and see what is either supporting climate work or actually has a reduced climate footprint. That is my soapbox and my request of all of you to just be a little more mindful. Aside from that, I'm sorry that I missed the March meeting. I was in Marin hosting a data and tech in wildfire conference, which went very well. And looking at specifically the data gaps that we have right now that maybe the insurance industries could use in reevaluating their risk modeling. And in doing that and in bringing that also here to a Climate Week event that we hosted in Altadena, I had the opportunity to meet with a woman who is part of the Eaton Fire Residents United group. And something that I would like this board to pay attention to and look into, I'm sure it comes as no surprise that the Eaton Fire neighborhoods in Altadena, and I'm sure the same for Palisades, are still facing vast contamination. And in case anybody doesn't know, it is up to each resident, each property owner, to decide whether or not they want to remediate their site, which personally to me sounds insane. And then they have to go through the process of actually applying for remediation and applying for insurance coverage. And in all of that, since it's being sort of decentralized and democratized, there's also a lack of communication happening from some of our public agencies around health concerns and health risks, serious health concerns and health risks, the kind that you have seen here locally and nationally after major catastrophic events, you know, years later, people popping up with mesothelioma or other such kind of cancer clusters. I am not a doctor, and also I feel like it's not that hard to connect the dots that some of these neighborhoods are potentially at risk of something similar down the line. And so one of the big questions is about the ash, you know, this toxic ash that's come from not just forest and trees, but the burning of cars, fuels, housing materials, things like that. And what is that ash diaspora, and how are people potentially going to be impacted by that? How is our water quality going to be impacted by that? So these are pieces of information that the community is hungry for, and that I know it's outside of our technical jurisdiction, you know, ash diaspora, but it does have an impact on our water quality, and I would love for this board to be able to at least point folks like this in the right direction of finding the information and the help that they need. And that is it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Board Member Camacho.
Yes, I have a few things to report. One thing is I did also attend the Alondra Park Multi-Benefit Stormwater Capture Project as well. And I have to say that he was talking about, you know, 40 acre feet of capture in there, but the site right now is under construction, and the cavern that's been built, I mean, it is like enormous. I really, if you can, other board members, I encourage you to go and see the site, because it is quite the engineering marvel. And so it's going to be, it was really impressive, and really thank the County of LA for really arranging that and taking us to at the critical point of the construction project. And so very, very impressed with that and the progress of that project. And so I know that they're going to be having a ribbon cutting sometime in 2026, so I look forward to that as well. And then going to April 9th, I had the opportunity to go to the Regional Oversight Committee of Safe Clean Water, and the focus of discussion there is on the biennial report, and so it's the second of the public sessions, and we are going to be starting to initiate the drafting of the biennial report, which is going to be presented to the Board of Supervisors, I believe, in the December timeframe. And so I have volunteered my services to be on that drafting subcommittee so that we could ensure that much of the water quality concerns are addressed. And speaking of that, we are on the agenda for the May 14th ROC meeting to discuss the recommendations from the water quality subcommittee or work group that has been established, and to incorporate goals and objectives into the Safe Clean Water Program. And so we're going to have the discussion on May 14th with the larger group, and hopefully we get some concurrence on that so that we could move that forward into the biennial report as well. And so, and that's all I have right now. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, thank you to all of the board members for everything that you do, even, you know, outside of this forum. This is just such an excellent board to be a part of, really. Thank you. As a citizen, I thank you. I've got a couple of things. First, thank you for attending that meeting and for your work on the Santa Monica Bay Restoration Commission, Vice Chair. Thank you for that. And to your comments, Board Member Christensen, I know that there's a lot of these conversations that are happening between our staff and folks at the state level, OES and others, and I think there's going to be a lot of focus on how the homeowners are going to move forward if the feds are not going to do the testing, which they're not. It's just removal of 6 inches, and so, you know, the question will become then: will the builders build? Will the insurers insure? Will the lenders lend? Will other agencies permit, and so on? There's a lot that needs to be discussed, and I know that staff are part of these conversations happening. And who knows, maybe at WQCC there will be some discussion of this. So I had a couple of things to share. First, I'm also privileged to chair the Los Angeles Business Council, a progressive business organization, and we have our mayoral housing summit tomorrow, starting at the ungodly hour of 7:30 a.m., but you know, I don't know why I deserve that kind of punishment, but and for those of you who may be interested, it will stream. The event is sold out. It will be at the UCLA Luskin Center, but we will be talking a lot about homelessness, housing, and what kind of policies we can bring to bear. The mayor will be there, so if any of you have the time and are interested, it will be streaming, and I think it can be accessed on the Los Angeles Business Council website. And the next thing that I wanted to report has to do with my good friend and predecessor Norma Camacho, and you know we were going to surprise Norma with this, and so this wasn't agendized for this meeting, because then you would have known what it is. But instead of that, we do have a resolution to thank Norma for her really stellar service as chair for 2 years, and I very much wanted to do this for Norma, because I want one of these when I stop being chair. I want to establish that right now. What about that do you find so amusing? So we do have, seriously, a resolution of appreciation. It's long and very beautiful, but I am going to read it. Okay. Resolution of appreciation for Norma Camacho from the Los Angeles Regional Water Quality Control Board. Whereas Norma Camacho has served with distinction as chair of the Los Angeles Regional Water Quality Control Board for the past 2 years, providing exceptional leadership, integrity, and a steadfast commitment to advance the board's mission to preserve and enhance water quality in the Los Angeles region for the benefit of present and future generations. Whereas, under Norma's leadership, the board advanced public health for all with a focus on communities historically overburdened by pollution and environmental hazards. Whereas, Norma guided the board through deliberations and actions on some of the most complex and high-profile regulatory matters, including the adoption of new waste discharge requirements for irrigated agricultural lands, a landmark step in regulating agricultural runoff and protecting groundwater. Whereas she served as a member of the Safe Clean Water Program's Regional Oversight Committee, where she championed science-based decision-making and advanced cross-agency coordination to improve long-term water quality outcomes across the region. Whereas she was instrumental in assisting with the selection of the board's first Latina executive officer, a milestone in the advancement of diversity, equity, and inclusion within the Water Board's leadership. We're not ashamed of those words. Whereas Norma supported the integration of racial equity and environmental justice into program planning with a focus on inspections and remediation in high-scoring Cal Enviro Screen communities and the expansion of supplemental environmental projects that directly benefit those most affected by pollution, and strengthened tribal consultation for the board. Whereas Norma champions the board's proactive response to the 2025 Los Angeles County wildfires, recognizing their impacts on watersheds and water quality, and supported interagency collaboration. Now, therefore, be it resolved, the Los Angeles Regional Water Quality Control Board expresses its deepest gratitude to Norma Camacho for her visionary leadership, collaborative spirit, and tireless dedication to protecting and improving water quality within the region. And be it further resolved that this resolution be entered into the official records of the Los Angeles Regional Water Quality Control Board, and that a copy be presented to Norma Camacho as a token of our reverence, admiration, and sincere appreciation. This will be formally adopted at our next meeting, and it's signed by David Nahai as chair and Susana Arredondo as executive officer. So let me hand it to you. So, yes, you have to say something.
I am just so struck. And again, I didn't expect this. This is quite the surprise, actually. And so, but I just wanted to let you know that really appreciate this honor. I mean, just getting on to this board, to me, is honor enough just to be here. And the ability to do, the opportunity to do all this good work is just amazing for me. And so, thank you all so much for that recognition. And again, It takes a village, and so all the many of these things I've been a part of, but it takes all of us to be really successful in accomplishing this all. And so not only are we applauding my chairmanship, but I applaud all of you who have been a part of this to help get this all done. So thank you very much.
Congratulations, Norma. Congratulations. All right, we move to our next item, which is the selection of subcommittees. So I'll ask our legal counsel, Adriana Nunez, to list our current list of subcommittees, and we'll make some decisions.
Currently, there are two active subcommittees, the Public Outreach Committee, which it consists of Board Chair David Nahai and Board Member Norma Camacho. And then there's our Racial Equity and Environmental Justice / SEPS Committee, which consists of Board Member Mike Mendez and Vice Chair Sabrina Ashion. We have two subcommittees on hiatus. That's the Industrial Task Force and the Water Resilience Subcommittee. So if there are any updates or subcommittees that you'd like to add, or if you'd like to remove any of the subcommittees that have been on hiatus, the Industrial Task Force Subcommittee has been on hiatus since January 2023. The Water Resilience Subcommittee has been on hiatus since February 2024.
Do not count the Litigation Subcommittee?
These are the subcommittees that were formed in open session. The Litigation Subcommittee is a closed session subcommittee.
Oh, okay. So are there any, the Industrial Task Force Subcommittee has not been active for a very, very long time. I don't see any reason to resurrect it at this point. The Water Resilience Subcommittee, I don't know if there are thoughts about that.
Not about water resilience, but wondering if, given recent events, we should add a wildfire resilience subcommittee.
Yes, we should. And I know that you have some thoughts on that, if you'd like to.
Yes, what I was thinking about doing, especially in light of your comments as well, too, to broaden the focus of the Public Outreach Committee to include the wildfire events that have occurred. And I know that we have been concentrating on the Regional Oversight Committee over this last year in terms of public outreach, but I think it would behoove us to create or broaden the Public Outreach Committee to basically address public concerns regarding the wildfires, public concerns regarding rebuilding, and rebuilding in such a way to promote resilience, and especially with a lot of the septic tanks, cleanups, all of these, I think, warrant a special subcommittee to address these public concerns.
Yeah, I would say, any thoughts?
Yeah, I definitely would support that that motion or proposal to expand the outreach subcommittee to include issues of wildfire, water resilience. I think within that, we could have maybe a more formal engagement with the consortium of academic researchers that presented to us last month. I know our EO is also having separate meetings with other researchers that I recommended. So I think that would be an excellent time to have a little bit more engagement with what are they finding, because there's already preliminary testing that they have done over both wet and dry testing times. So I think that would be a great opportunity to expand it to that as well.
Okay. All right, then. Do I need a vote on this regarding expanding the role of the Public Outreach Subcommittee to encompass communications on the aftermath of the wildfires?
Yes, I'd appreciate that. Do we want to change the name of the Public Outreach Committee, or just say Public Outreach parenthetical with a particular emphasis on?
I don't think we need to change its name. It's just that basically its birth will comprise both the Safe Clean Water Program and the activities of the Regional Oversight Committee, where We're represented by chair, by board member Camacho, but also a focus on the aftermath of the wildfires and the recovery and rebuilding.
I will say it's if we don't change the name, fine, but it may be worth pushing some communications just to let people know that this board is a source of information for the wildfire recovery efforts, you know, specifically.
Okay. Does anybody think we need to change the name of it in order to better? I think the name is fine.
I think it's fine, if, okay. As long as we can make it obvious, you know, to folks that this it's a resource.
All right.
Can we revisit maybe in the next couple months having actual maybe an hour or two of that subcommittee in public in one of our meetings where we can have an open one in open forum, but also prepare presentations from individuals that we all agree should be presenting to us?
Yeah, that's a great idea.
I think absolutely. Again, I just want to make sure that staff's involvement with state board and with OES and so I think we absolutely must have a public conversation. This is our region, and we have responsibilities here. We have to think about the timing and the sensitivity of what we're doing. I think so.
Just one thing that I just wanted to mention, given the broader nature of this committee, do we think we want to add one more person? Is there a possibility of having three people?
No,
we cannot. Okay.
No, because three then it starts becoming an open meeting. Yeah, so that's why. Okay. All right. With that, we'll move on to the executive officer's report.
Oh, my apologies. Did we want to just formally vote on the changes to the subcommittee?
I'm sorry?
Can we just take a formal roll call vote for the changes to the subcommittee?
Oh, okay. Of course. Ms. Rowe?
Vice Chair Ashion?
Oh, yeah. Excuse me. You wanted a motion and a second first.
Yes.
Okay. Board Member Camacho moved. Mm-hmm. Board Member Christensen seconded. Could we have the roll vote, please?
Vice Chair Ashion?
Yes, thank you.
Board Member Camacho?
Yes.
Board Member Christensen?
Yes.
Board Member Mendez?
Yes.
Chair Nahai?
Yes.
Motion carries. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Adriana. All right, now we can move on to the Executive Officer's Report. Ms. Arredondo?
Thank you, Chair. I have one update, and it's on the Carson and Wilmington Refinery cessation of operations, community engagement, and cleanup plans. On April 16th and 17th, the site cleanup program staff and management met with Phillips 66 and their consultants. At a separate meeting, staff and management met with public interest groups, Asian Pacific Environmental Network, and Communities for a Better Environment. The topic of both meetings was the cessation of operations, decommission, and eventual redevelopment of the two refineries under the Los Angeles Water Board Cleanup and Abatement Order 94-139, Carson and Wilmington. At both sites, Phillips 66 and their consultants presented a path forward while emphasizing their willingness to work with the board and their commitment to remediate the sites as part of the process towards redevelopment. Phillips 66 plans to submit a proposal for interim enhancements to both master work plans. The objective of the interim actions are to maintain compliance, enhance the progress of remediation, and integrate the remediation program with the redevelopment program. At the same time, Phillips 66 stated the prospective purchasers for the properties are discussing a CLARA agreement with DTSE. During the meeting with the public interest group, staff and management answered questions about the regulatory process that governed the remediation of these sites. The groups were primarily concerned with timelines of redevelopment and cleanup goals and the financial assurance needed for the work to be completed. Staff and management explained the rough timelines presented by Phillips 66, pointing to their existing regulatory cleanup goals. In addition, they emphasized the public participation steps that will allow for transparency and public comment on the final remediation action plan. Both Carson and Wilmington refineries are set to cease operations in the fourth quarter of this year, opening the door to opportunities of enhanced remediation and eventual redevelopment. We'll keep the board updated on any new developments, and this concludes my report.
Thank you very much. Okay, any questions for the executive officer on that report? No? It's okay, seeing none. We'll move on then to our next item, which is an update from our state water board liaison board member, Laurel Firestone.
Hi, good morning. Can you hear me?
Hi, good morning. We can hear you, great. But we can't see you yet.
Okay.
Oh, now we can see you.
All right. Well, good to see you all. And my report is fairly short. We have the Water Quality Coordinating Committee meeting coming up on May 1st and 2nd. So that's next week. And I know I'll see some of you there, a lot of you there, but it's a really great chance to get all of the regional boards and state board folks together. And this has been going on really every year since the creation of and adoption of Porter Cologne since 1970. So just encourage people to join if they can't in person, then remotely. It's a public meeting as well. A few things that we've been up to, we held a public hearing on our 2026 integrated report and got comments on the draft 2026 303D list. We and the public comment period closed earlier this month. We are going to be considering adoption of that probably early 2026. We also released a draft utility wildfire general order. So this for public comment, and this is part of an effort to have a statewide general order that helps streamline utility wildfire prevention activities. We're hoping to have adoption by the end of this year. In the meantime, there's been executive orders and a lot of efforts to address those issues this year. We're continuing to go through the Delta Conveyance Project hearings, more information can be found on our website, but we continue to have pretty regularly hearings on that project moving forward. We did our first public meeting to use a new power around a sewer system administrator appointment for East Orosi Community Services District. Public comments can be submitted on that, but this would be the first time that we've used that authority that was granted in statute. And we held an info session, an update on our work around SGMA, Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. We heard from staff on sort of the progress that's been made and status. We're continuing to move through the basins that have been found inadequate by DWR. Our next one that we're considering will likely be coming up around in June around Chowchilla. And we have, as I think I mentioned before, we've given a little bit more time to Kern before we made a final decision on that, and that hearing is set for September. Department of Water Resources also gave an update and has found one additional basin inadequate, and so we are going to be looking at that one as well. It's also in the San Joaquin Valley. Just a few kind of teasers for things coming up At our May 6th board meeting, we are going to be considering adoption of our updated policy for both the drinking water and clean water state revolving funds. There's been a process around public comment, stakeholder engagement, and so this would be adoption of that. But the intended use plan, which is really the fundable project list, will be released very soon and will be considered. There'll be a hearing going and then final adoption later this summer. So look out for that. You know, I think some of the discussion earlier by the board on, you know, thinking about language and federal funding is certainly an issue for us as we think about how to make sure that federal funding for drinking water and clean water isn't imperiled by certain terms, but that the work continues and the commitment to serving those areas most in need and building the kind of resiliency that we need in the state continues. We also are going to have an update on May 6th on our underground storage tank cleanup fund and program, and also a workshop on Region 9's biological objectives that they've proposed in their basin plan update. This would be the first time that those would be set statewide. And so we're having a workshop to hear more about that approach. And I think those were the main things that I wanted to mention. We continue to work a lot on water rights modernization activities and supporting financial assistance for projects, including recycled water, drinking water, clean water. That's the highlights.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Questions for board member Firestone? No questions for you today. We very much look forward to seeing you at WQCC, I think, the end of next week.
Yeah, great. Look
Thank
forward to
so
it as
much.
Well. Thanks.
Thanks. All right, next we will move to public forum. So each speaker will have 3 minutes to address the board. Unless additional time has been approved in advance. And I would just add that comments during public forum must be on items that are not pending or scheduled to appear on a future agenda and which are not otherwise on today's agenda. We will start first by hearing commenters who are here in person. Then from there, we'll move on to folks who may be participating remotely. And we would ask them to raise their Zoom hand, and our technical staff will patch them in. So in terms of the cards that I have here for our in-person speakers, we will start with Jennifer Novak. Hi, Ms. Novak.
Good morning, Chair Nahai and members of the board. My name is Jennifer Novak, and I'm here on behalf of WRCS, which is a nonprofit that has spent the last 9 years working to bring affordable housing to Lincoln Park. Last month, you heard from WRCS' CEO about the project and her continued hope for collaboration with staff to get this project built. I want to note that this is a critical moment. WRCS is under intense pressure to secure approvals from this board and from the City of Los Angeles so that construction can begin this summer. And if approvals don't come soon, the funding window will close and the project will die. Now, WRCS evaluated 5 different properties before settling on the one at issue here, and I wish the city had an abundance of pristine properties that it could offer up for low-income and affordable housing. It doesn't. But unlike many properties that staff has to oversee, there is no clear source of on-site pollution here. The site was residential, and then it was a parking lot, There is no known historic spill or discharge, and the data certainly don't support a finding that there have been multiple such spills in the past. Neither staff nor our consultants can identify an on-site source, and the highest detections are in the southeast corner, which is the first area hit by groundwater. Since the last meeting, we have had two very productive meetings with staff and leadership, and I know that staff is clearly trying to find a way to move us forward, but they are still asking for off-site testing and infrastructure. Works does not have that kind of time or that kind of funding to investigate a regional issue that it did not create and that cannot be clearly attributed to this property. There is no budget to install infrastructure for a risk that might not exist, and there is no money coming for that extra work. What we do have is a science-based plan to safely manage the soil and to protect the residents on this site, and it is a plan rooted in health and safety, and we would like that remedial action plan approved. If we collectively want to solve California's housing crisis, we cannot keep doing business as usual. I know it is uncomfortable, but it's necessary. We need to ask not just where contamination may have come from, but what really blocks housing from being built, and whether we are standing in the way of the very solutions that we say we support. Staff's willingness to engage with us is appreciated. I cannot tell you how amazing it was to see that many members of staff and leadership on a call with us to try to come up with solutions. But we need action now. And this is especially so in light of the news from yesterday that the city of Los Angeles is going to slash its housing budget conceivably by 80%, which means more than ever, we need to move forward with the projects that we can do. Please do not let this project die over a hypothetical risk that no one can tie to this property and that works cannot afford to take. Let's be part of the solution and move this forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Also, we have a letter of support from the city who could not be here for a variety of issues. Could we leave this with the clerk as well?
Yeah, I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Please submit it. I think this is not the first time that we've heard about this project at the board level. Do we have a response for Ms. Novak at this point? Or
Ms. Novak and board, I did want to thank you for your comment and your attendance today. I did want to let the board know that this project continues to be top priority for our staff and for the executive team, and we're currently reviewing the remedial action plan, and we should be returning it to them here very soon. And we understand they're under a tight timeline. So, yeah.
Okay, we appreciate it. Thank you. The next card I have is from Mr. Ray Tahir.
Morning, board members.
For 3 minutes, please.
I may go over by a few seconds. Next slide, please. Board chair and staff ignored my email request on April 1st to provide data regarding monitoring relating to the Altadena-Eaton fire. At the March 27th board meeting, AEO Newman said that monitoring was done in Altadena, albeit not to the same extent as the Palisades. She also said that MS4 permittees had done fire impact monitoring, but didn't provide any details. I asked for the information to be provided by April 11th, 10 days after the request. It is apparent that the regional board is more concerned with the Palisades than Altadena. Demographic differences in terms of race and income probably account for the disparity. Please note, as of April 21st, the Altadena monitoring data AEO Newman referenced at the last meeting was not posted on the board's website. Next slide, please. Despite this, I submitted a public records request on April 17th to board staff to provide the information, specifically, one, the dates and locations where the monitoring, that is, sampling and analysis, was conducted and by whom, two, the pollutants that were sampled for, three, the dates and locations of outfalls of receiving waters, that is, flood control channels that were conducted by MS4 permittees, and the name of the permittees. The information is needed to determine if the board had correctly identified pollutants to be monitored. Apparently, lead and benzene were not among them. Next slide, please. The LA Times reported on April 16th that two Altadena groups independently found levels far exceeding 100 times the APA limit within standing homes in the Eaton Burn area. And please take note of this. With little government and insurance support for testing, some residents are already moving back. Others fear Altadena is on the precipice of an environmental health disaster, something that Ms. Christensen had referenced. Lead exposure can lead to irreversible damage to the brain and nervous system, especially in children. This raises the question, why didn't the regional board, as a governmental agency, take an interest in monitoring for lead? Next slide, please. The LA Times also reported on February 27th a problem with benzene. Water utilities in both Eaton and Palisade fire burn areas of SCARS have reported detecting the carcinogen benzene in parts of their water systems. Water quality monitoring for the Palisades, which focused on ocean water and sediment and beach sand, did not include benzene, and it is unlikely that monitoring for Altadena included benzene as well. Board member Mendez at the last meeting expressed concern for benzene levels in Altadena associated with melted plastic. The greatest source of benzene is gasoline, along with other carcinogens, including toluene, ethylbenzene, and xylene, BTEX.
How much more time do you need?
30 seconds. Okay. These pollutants are especially concerning for Altadena because they contaminate groundwater, unlike the Palisades. Unlike the Palisades, Altadena is more dependent on groundwater. Hundreds, if not thousands, of vehicles were destroyed by Altadena fire and released gasoline into the subsurface with a potential to contaminate groundwater. Next slide, please. I want to show you this picture, then I'll be out of here. Here's some examples of the burnt-out cars. Notice on the slide to the right that the gas tank had been blown open by the fire, and apparently gasoline had leaked out onto the surface and then infiltrated possibly into the subsurface. Lastly, in the final analysis, it should be apparent that soil sampling and analysis targeting BTEX and other VOCs, PAS, PCBs, and PFOS, PFAS need to be conducted in Altadena, and that it should be paid for by the regional board as it had for the Palisades.
Okay.
I want to congratulate Ms. Christensen for meeting with Altadena residents, hearing their concerns about the potential impact and real impact of the fire on the environment there. And also thank you for recommending the creation of a wildfire committee. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I'll just address the Public Records Act component of Mr. Tahir's comments. We did receive an email requesting certain information relating to the dates and timing of monitoring and the locations. It wasn't clearly a records request, and so we were treating it as a letter to respond to. He sent a subsequent email making it clear what records he was more clear what records he was seeking, and that is being processed as a Public Records Act request.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Newman?
Thank you, Adriana. May I add substantively that the water quality data that he is requesting is available on the LA County Environmental Health dashboard. We've been working with them through SQRP and our coordinated monitoring effort to upload that data to that dashboard, as I understand, it's not available yet, but as soon as it is, it will be uploaded to that dashboard. And we can link to that dashboard, if we haven't already, on our regional board webpage so folks know where to find it.
Okay. Yeah, I think that would be good. Board Member Mendez?
Sure. Thank you. I'd like to, again, thank staff for the tremendous amount of work that they've done over the last several months. I know it's a very hard and trying time in working with multiple federal, state, and other regional local entities. And I'm very happy that everyone supported the proposal to expand our outreach on the Altadena fire in particular, because there are perceptions that there is disparate and disparate responses to the fires. While some aspects may be true, some are not. But having, in the coming months, having a public forum through that new subcommittee would be important, where we can publicly unveil this dashboard on the academic and other research consortiums' research that's going ongoing. I was recently, just last week, in the Coachella Valley for a side event of the Coachella Festival by local social justice organizations and farm worker organizations. One of two side events I attended was Mobius, and the other one was Farmcella, which was honoring farm workers in the area. At these events, there was a senior executive from Ultimate Health Clinic, which many of you may know. That's a low-income, Medi-Cal, Medicaid, largely supported community health clinic. She told us it was burned live on TV in Altadena, one of the largest provider for low-income individuals, and she herself explicitly mentioned about the disparate perceptions of recovery and rebuilding and the speed that will occur. So those sentiments are valid and are out there. So I think having this new subcommittee can really show the work that the regional board and the staff is doing, and we can always use additional guidance. So I think that would be a public forum on areas that we have gaps. The public can hold us accountable. So I applaud those efforts and look forward to getting that scheduled in the near future.
Thank you. You have a
comment? Yes. I just wanted to respond to Mr. Tahir's comment in regards to the disparate treatment. And I think that Board Member Mendez said it well, that this public outreach committee will try to serve to alleviate those fears that are out there, that there is a preference to one area over the other in terms of the rebuilding process. And I know for myself, we need to rebuild everybody fairly and equitably. And so I thank Mr. Tahir for bringing up what the sentiment is out there. And we'll do our best to correct and show the community that we value everybody equally and want everybody to get back up and running again safely.
Yep. Here, here. Okay. All right, thank you. And if you could please make sure that Mr. Tahir gets the link to access the information that he's looking for. And I think I would just echo the sentiments here that for this board there is no differentiation between the residents of one area and the residents of another area. They're all equally important to us, and we have a humanitarian crisis that we need to deal with, as human beings. So there may be this perception out there that Mr. Tahir referred to, but that perception is not reality where this board is concerned. So, okay. Let's move on. I believe we have one speaker who will join us remotely, and that's Walter Lamb of the Biona Wetlands Land Trust for 3 minutes. That's the only speaker that I have remotely. I don't know if there are others that are waiting in line. Okay, so let's join in Mr. Lamb.
Thank you, Chair Nahai, Vice Chair Osjohn, and board members. Walter Lamb, with the Biona Wetlands Land Trust. And I want to say I appreciated the upfront comment today from Vice Chair Osjohn and also Board Member Christensen on what happened at the Santa Monica Bay Restoration Commission meeting last week. And I appreciate that these are difficult times and that there's no perfect answer, right? And striking the balance between when to take a stand, when to strike a deal, you know, maybe when to take a stand so that you strike a better deal. That's difficult. I'm not trying to impose my subjective views on anyone. The concern, however, is with the narrative that, you know, just keep doing the work, even if you have to change the language. I think it's far more complicated and nuanced than that. And, you know, I won't have time today to get into all the examples, but we view this as an ongoing discussion, and we really want your help ensuring that really does turn out to be true, because we're seeing many, many signs already that it's not, and that it's not all the language coming out of the federal administration isn't about just what things are called. It's about the actual work. And if you read the executive orders, you'll see that. Specifically, Vice Chair Osjohn, you know, what really concerned me last week was more the language of how you expressed yourself. And you said, we need to do what we need to do in order to get grant funding, because grant funding, it's by law, it's not by statute, It's just if they decide they want to give it to us or not. The federal administration can do what they want and can decide not to give us money. They do not have to. There is no law that says they do. And I just want to point out that the grant that we're talking about, the name of it is the Clean Water Act Section 320 NEP grant. So Clean Water Act Section 320 is the statute. And in the meeting, there was discussion of the regulations. And just so to be clear, the regulations state that they don't have the discretion to deny the grant outright. They would first have to go through a negotiation period. So it went from being that it could be denied to maybe speculatively it could be delayed. This was informal, unwritten guidance. Nobody actually knew what the words were. And I'll say that, you know, another way to think about this is just to listen to what you all have said today and the power of saying those words out loud. You said many, many so-called trigger words. So if the transcript of this meeting was in the work plan, then allegedly it would get rejected, right? So think about, even with the tribute to former Chair Camacho and racial equity and the committees that you're talking about, you'd have to do that same work without saying those words. I think it would be a little more difficult than maybe some people are imagining. So let's keep this conversation going. It's really, really important. And we want to make sure that the work actually can get done. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for your comments. Any questions for Ms. Hannam, from any of the board members? Okay, we'll move on. And with sincere apologies, I overlooked a speaker card that I have here from Mr. Eric. And I have to apologize again if I'm not quite reading the last name correctly, but it looks like Eric Kraras of the Los Angeles Housing Department.
That's correct.
I'm so sorry about that. Believe me, it was not intentional.
It's okay. No problem. Okay. So good morning, board members. My name is Eric Glados. I'm the Director of Housing Innovation Strategies for the Los Angeles Housing Department. I'm here to speak on behalf of LAHD in support of the project with the developer works located at 216 through 2224 South Avenue 24 in the Lincoln Heights community. We have been working on this site as a city since 2016, and we are at near the finish line here. We have currently a disposition and development agreement with the development organization, and we're currently working on finalizing a ground lease. The city has made a commitment of approximately $12.4 million to this project, and right now the issue we're facing is the additional remediation that's essentially being asked of this development for an off-site contamination source that it's not responsible for. And this proposed development is 48 units in total, 47 of which are for large families, homeless transitional age youth, and people with disabilities. So it's going to fill an important need in this community. Right now, we have been a longstanding partner with this organization to secure funding. It is pretty much fully funded and ready to break ground as soon as we can execute a ground lease amendment. And the issue right now we're facing is not just about providing additional funding to pay for the remediation, which is a very real issue. We don't essentially have additional funds to put in, but also of timing, because we have a looming deadline in June. So I'm here to ask for whatever flexibility this or this body can provide to this project so that we can actually move it forward and finish it, because it's very difficult to build housing. It's very, very difficult to build affordable housing with all the approvals that are required and all the additional impositions such as, you know, prevailing wages and additional ADA requirements imposed. So we really want to let the main thing be the main thing here and just build the housing. We understand the, you know, additional requirements that are triggered because of its funding source. And just, you know, again, here to provide support. We do support the alternative plan from Works that includes a robust vapor mitigation system to protect future tenants of the project. And lastly, I do want to acknowledge the staff of this body, because my colleagues, the end of the development team, have been meeting with them regularly, and we understand that, you know, they we want to express our gratitude that they are willing to meet with us and work with us on such a condensed time frame, and just really want to thank you for your time, and again ask for any flexibility that can be provided here. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for your comments, and thank you for your service at LAHD. Appreciate it. Are there any responses to Mr. Clara's comments?
I just want to echo what our executive officer said earlier and recognize that this is an important project, and we do recognize that. And at the same time, you know, we have our process that we have to follow to ensure the protection of those residents and the environment. So we're going to follow our process as we always do. And as mentioned, we should have a response to the remedial action plan very shortly.
Okay, thank you. I hope that in following that process, we can also meet the deadlines, the seemingly severe deadlines that the project is under to try to move it forward. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Oh, could I ask one?
Go ahead.
Yeah, if I could ask one question of staff. So I just wanted to make sure that the negotiations are ongoing and it's not at a standstill right now, correct?
Correct. There's been a lot of discussion, and things are moving along, but it's not stagnant at all. Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions on this? All right. Any other speakers waiting remotely? No? Okay. All right. With that, then, we'll move on to our uncontested items. We have one item, item 8, that is uncontested, and I think that I can probably move forward to ask for a motion, unless any board member would like to pull this off the uncontested item list.
I would make a motion to approve.
Okay.
Second.
I have a motion from Vice Chair Ashton and a second from Board Member Mendez. Let's have the roll call vote, please.
Vice Chair Ashton?
Yes.
Board Member Camacho?
Yes.
Board Member Christensen?
Yes.
Board Member Mendez?
Yes.
Chair Nahai?
Yes.
Motion carries. Thank you.
Thank you. And with that, we have our enforcement item, which is the overview of the enforcement process, including a discussion of settlement components from the Office of Enforcement. Hang on, before you come up, I want to make sure the board members are okay. We just continue?
Yeah, I have until
11. Yeah, we'll be fine. We'll be fine. All right, please, we're all yours. Thank you, Mr. Colby.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Nahai, Vice Chair Ashton, and members of the board. My name is Russ Colby. I am currently serving as the Acting Assistant Executive Officer of the Regional Board in the Groundwater Division. I'd like to introduce item 9. It's the overview of the enforcement process, including a discussion of settlement components. You may recall at a previous meeting, we had the Office of Enforcement come down from the State Board and give you an overview of some changes to the enforcement policy that took effect in 2024. We thought this would be a good time to kind of get into some of the things that you don't normally hear about within that process, including enforcement prioritization, settlement, what entails a settlement, some of the things that you don't get to hear a lot of. And my apologies that I can't talk a lot of sometimes, I know, to your frustration. So I'd like to introduce Kaylin Ellison and Catherine Hall with the Office of Enforcement. They're both attorneys. We are also pleased to have them both as our Region 4 liaisons, and also David Boyers, who is the Assistant Chief Counsel with the Office of Enforcement.
Good morning. Can I have the next slide, please? Is that better?
That's much better. Thank you.
Well, good morning. As Russ mentioned, my name is Kaylin Ellison. I'm one of your attorneys from the Office of Enforcement. I believe you've seen a lot of me recently. So today we will be talking about an overview of the enforcement process, and we're going to start with how we identify cases for enforcement and then prioritize cases. Next slide. On a daily basis, your staff is working with the regulated community to ensure that they are complying with applicable water quality laws and permits. Staff identify potential cases through inspections, either by staff or by other agencies. We also receive complaints from the public, and we review reports submitted by permittees, or we notice that the permittees did not submit a report that they should have. Next slide. So then what do we do once we identify that there's a problem? It is important to note that not all violations will proceed to enforcement. There's a lot of work that can be done more informally through phone calls, emails, or notices of violation, and oftentimes that resolves the issue. We prefer compliance over enforcement where possible. However, the prosecution team does retain broad discretion on how to approach cases, and there may be emergency situations or other scenarios where bypassing these more informal processes is appropriate. Next slide. And unfortunately, there are more violations than resources for us to prosecute those violations. So that's where prioritization comes in. So your program staff and permitting staff will meet periodically, usually quarterly, to discuss potential cases and give updates on existing cases. And then they'll decide if there are new cases, if they should be referred to your enforcement units one or two. So prioritization and selection of cases is all based on the unique facts of the potential cases. So once we decide we're going to take enforcement, your staff requests assignment of an attorney from the Office of Enforcement to represent the prosecution team. Unlike your OCC attorneys, the Office of Enforcement attorneys are not assigned to regions, they're assigned to specific cases. So your staff works with just about every attorney in the Office of Enforcement at some point. So the attorney then meets with your staff and we come up with a strategy and an approach for that specific case, including a discussion of which tool is appropriate for that case. A lot of the times, and what we're going to be focusing on here today, is administrative civil liabilities. But there are other tools that we often use, such as investigative orders, cleanup and abatement orders, or cease and desist orders. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Catherine Ha, and we'll discuss separation of functions.
Good morning. I'm taller than Kaylin. It's a pleasure to be in front of your board again. Can I have the next slide, please? So the foundational procedural issue that we are thinking about when we are conducting enforcement matters is separation of functions. And separation of functions is designed to ensure that your board can serve as a neutral decision maker, either in the adoption of a settlement or if we have to bring a contested item in front of you. Basically, what this requires is that staff who are going to serve in an advocacy role on the prosecution team are separated from both the board and the staff who will advise the board in their decision-making role. Next slide, please. So usually what this looks like in most cases in most regions throughout the state is that the assistant executive officer, compliance and enforcement staff, appropriate technical staff who have been working on the case, and then an attorney from the Office of Enforcement comprise the prosecution team. And then the advisory team generally consists of the executive officer, a technical staff person who has not been involved in the enforcement case but can provide the necessary expertise, and then an attorney from your Office of Chief Counsel. A point that's worth making here is that the prosecution team always has separation of functions on our minds when we're working with staff on a day-to-day basis, and we take steps to ensure that advisory staff and attorneys are walled off early in the investigation process. But often this is happening without the advisory team staff knowing that they've been walled off. So the board and or advisory staff may not realize that something has been going on and that they've been separated out to serve in that function until later in the process when a more formal enforcement action is put together. Next slide, please. I'm going to spend the next couple of slides talking about everybody's role in more detail between the various parties I just described or roles I just described. And a lot of what I'm going to discuss applies in both the settlement context and the contested enforcement action context, but we are focusing today on settlements, so most of my time will be spent on that. So the first thing that the prosecution team is engaged in is what Kaylin just talked about, which is that we are engaged in prioritizing how our enforcement resources will be deployed. And we take into account, while we're doing that, the priorities set by the board and executive officer. But that is a process that happens as, generally a confidential process between enforcement staff and the attorneys within the Office of Enforcement. When we appear in front of you, not today, it's a nice break, but generally, we appear advocating for a particular position. So we are asking for the board to either adopt a settlement as we've proposed, or we are asking for them to impose a penalty or some other sort of order that the prosecution team believes is the correct outcome. When we engage in settlement, the prosecution team is the only party. Obviously, the discharger or the regulated entity as well, but the prosecution team is the only party which represents the regional board's position in those settlement negotiations. When we're in settlement negotiations, it's the prosecution team's role to review the evidence, to review the violations, and to apply the enforcement policies methodology, which is what we were down here talking about last time I was in front of you, to determine what an appropriate liability is in the case and what an appropriate settlement posture is given the particular facts at hand. Importantly, as part of our role both in settlement and appearing in front of you in contested items, it's not the prosecution team's role to assist the discharger in preparing for hearing or engaging in the settlement process. we are adversarial to that party. We do answer questions, so both in the settlement process and when we're here in front of you at a hearing, we are always eager to resolve any concerns you might have about our items and to present the information that you're interested in hearing. Next slide, please. So the fundamental role of the advisory team is making sure that you as a board have access to both the legal and technical expertise that you need in order to make a decision on an enforcement action. Both the advisory team and the board are considered neutral within the enforcement process, so the advisory team and the board have an open line of communication, whereas the prosecution team is prohibited from engaging in those sorts of conversations on an ex parte basis. The advisory team can work with the board to request that particular items be submitted to them or questions are answered, and we've done that in both the settlement context and, you know, obviously at a hearing as well. That's who you will participate in your closed session briefings with on enforcement actions, generally speaking, and after those items are adopted. Prior to their adoption, the advisory team will assist the board in making sure that the order complies with all of the relevant policy guidance, including the enforcement policy or the supplemental environmental policy on supplemental environmental projects as well. And then if the order is adopted and is petitioned, then the advisory team staff generally assists with defending that order as well. Next slide, please. And then your role, last but not least. So the board's role generally is the fact finder and decision maker. So it's your responsibility to adopt a final order, whether that be a settlement order or an order that results after a contested evidentiary hearing. For both of those situations, the board does so in light of all policy, procedural, legal, and factual issues. You decide what weight to give any evidence that's submitted to you in a contested hearing and or how public comment should play into the resolution of a particular matter. And then when we bring you a contested item, you have the authority to say what you think the appropriate administrative civil liability is consistent with our enforcement policy. But your role in settlement is a little bit different. So next slide. Which is it's more restrictive. So when we bring you a settlement agreement as the prosecution team, you do not have the ability to modify it. What we are asking for the board to do in that situation is either to reject the settlement agreement or adopt the settlement agreement. There are a couple scenarios where that may not be as easy as saying yes or no. So the board has the option when considering a settlement agreement to tell the parties, the prosecution team being one of them, that they have insufficient information to make a decision. So in that instance, you can direct the parties to provide that information or say that it's inadequate and you will not adopt the settlement. If you do not agree with the settlement terms, including, for example, the inclusion or lack thereof of a SEP, you can tell the parties that, and we can, you know, make an attempt to renegotiate the settlement, or you, again, can reject the settlement at that point in time. As part of that role in settlement, we are very much keeping in mind a desire to preserve your role to hear an item if we need to bring it back to you as a contested item. So, again, you're not weighing the evidence as part of the process of adopting the settlement. You're merely saying yes or no and providing direction to the parties on what they may consider in negotiations or if they can provide information. Next rule. Next rule. Yikes, I'm reading at the same time. Next slide. And this is Kaylin's.
So with that background information in mind, we're going to talk about the three pathways for ACLs, or administrative civil liabilities. Next slide. So the first approach is compressed ACLs, and this is a somewhat new tool. So what this is it's a streamlined approach to settlement that is similar to expedited payment letters that your region has used for years for mandatory minimum penalties. And what it is that the prosecution team will prepare a single package of documents. Looks like something happened weird with that slide. But it's a single package that serves as the complaint, which is our settlement offer to the discharger. And it includes a penalty methodology explaining the proposed penalty and allows the discharger to waive their right to a hearing and pay the penalty. There's also an order for the board or the executive officer to sign as part of that package. So the goal here is that this would be a more streamlined approach. It's not appropriate for every case, and there's limited negotiations in this scenario. So once this package is sent out, it's a public document, and the goal is that there would be a waive and pay option for the discharger. So this tool has been used recently in your region for some construction stormwater cases with some positive results. And it works well when the violations are straightforward. They're supported by photos that are easy for the discharger to see what the violations are that we're alleging, or there's some sort of incentive for the discharger to accept the settlement offer. And this usually occurs if there are multiple violations that we could have alleged, but we're deciding to only allege the most egregious violation. So it's obvious to the discharger that there's an incentive to accept this settlement offer. Next slide, please. So assuming we don't use the compressed ACL approach, the other approach is trying to get a settlement in general. So this can either happen before or after issuance of an administrative civil liability complaint. In your region, the vast majority of cases settle before issuance of a complaint. And this is achieved by the prosecution team sending a letter to the discharger asking them if they would like to talk to us about settlement before we issue a complaint. And I'd say over 90% of the time, they accept our offer to engage in these negotiations. And we found that this approach is generally more efficient and takes less time for your staff. It also allows your staff to work on a variety of enforcement cases at once because they're not bound by firm hearing deadlines. And it allows the discharger the benefit of presenting facts and arguments to the prosecution team that may have us change our thoughts about the proposed penalty or the violations before any information is made public. Next slide, please. So, why do we settle? It's because there are several benefits to settlement. The first is that it allows certainty in the outcome of the case and eliminates the risk of going to hearing or protracted litigation, and the discharger will waive their right to appeal the decision. Second, as I said, settlements usually take fewer staff resources and time compared to ACL hearings. And lastly, and importantly, it allows the prosecution team to obtain concessions or incorporate elements that would not be available if we proceeded to a hearing, specifically supplemental environmental projects and enhanced compliance actions that the board is not able to adopt at a contested ACL hearing. And we'll be talking about SEPs and enhanced compliance actions more in this presentation. Next slide. So settlement negotiations are confidential, and as shown on the screen, it's governed by two evidence code provisions. And these provisions mean that it's inadmissible for us to discuss offers of compromise or offers to accept a sum of money at a subsequent administrative civil liability hearing. And this also encompasses any statements made during negotiations or conduct during those negotiations. So we understand that this can be very frustrating to the board and members of the public that we're not able to share the information of what occurred during settlement, but it's really because of these code sections and because it fosters a cooperative narrative between the prosecution team and the dischargers where we can have frank and open conversations. And protecting the integrity of that process is very important for your prosecution team's reputation with the regulated community. So, unfortunately, that means we will not always be able to answer questions that you may have about what occurred in settlement. There is an opportunity that we can ask the discharger to waive some of these code provisions to talk about discrete facts that we think may be important to you, such as why we may not have included a supplemental environmental project in the settlement, but that is optional and would need the discharger's permission in order to share that information with you. Next slide, please. So we can discuss how we reach a settlement in general, and settlements take time, so that's the first thing to point out. Every settlement is different. In general, a case may take 3 to 6 months just in the initial negotiation phase to reach an agreement in principle as to the penalty amount and the violations. Then after that, it may take a few more months to come up with a SEP or ECA and then finalize the settlement agreement. So while this does take time, we are mindful of that and push each step of the way to make sure that there is movement on the case throughout the process. So the most common ways that we reach a settlement is through the discharger providing new information to the prosecution team that we may not have had when we came up with our initial proposal. This results in us modifying the penalty amount through the various factors in the enforcement policy. However, there are times where even with new information, we still think that we are correct and that the opposed penalty is appropriate. So one other thing we look at is weighing litigation risks, and this has to do with equitable factors. There may be evidentiary issues in the case or other weaknesses in the case that have come out through the settlement process. And then we may propose a modest reduction in the penalty amount. So all settlements are transparent and public, and you will see in the settlement that it will go through the 10 steps of the enforcement policy, describing the facts and reasoning for how we calculated the penalty, as well as there will be a discussion if there's any reduction for litigation risks. So now I'll turn it back over to Catherine, and we'll talk about SEPs and ECAs.
So these are some frequently encountered questions about SEPs, and I encourage you all, if you have questions that I'm not going to address in the next couple slides, to please ask. I find that this is an area that the boards generally are quite interested in, especially because most of our boards care quite deeply about environmental justice, and this is one of the ways that our enforcement cases can serve those goals. So I'm going to go over in more detail what is a SEP, how are they selected, what are the parties' roles in selecting them, what rules apply, and how the projects are identified. Next slide, please. So this is the definition of a SEP. It comes from the Public Resources Code, and I'm going to talk about each of these or various elements of this definition in more detail. The first is that a SEP is an environmentally beneficial project, which means that it must improve, protect, or reduce risks to public health or the environment. In the context of our policy, those are the kinds of projects which benefit groundwater, surface water, or drinking water quality or quantity, and the beneficial uses of waters of the state. The next important element to emphasize here is that a SEP needs to be a project which is agreed to be undertaken voluntarily. That means that the prosecution team or the board cannot make a discharger agree to include a SEP in a settlement. It needs to be something that the party is willing to agree to do. The other thing about this stuff, about this particular element, is that this also means that a SEP cannot be a project that a party is otherwise compelled to do in order to comply with some other regulatory requirement, including a requirement that's imposed by an agency other than the Water Board. The next part of this I want to emphasize is in settlement of the action, which means that the prosecution team, when we are engaging in settlement negotiations, can agree to include a SEP, but if we are in front of your board with a contested item, the board cannot direct that a SEP be included as an outcome of that. And then this really is one of the greatest benefits to engaging in settlement negotiations, is that these sorts of projects are only available in that context. And the last is this last portion here, which is to offset a portion of a civil liability, meaning that SEPs are included when we are resolving administrative civil liabilities and we are sending money to the project in lieu of sending it to the State Water Board's cleanup and abatement account. Next slide. So how do the parties, which is the prosecution team and the discharger, find SEPs to include in the settlement? The first option, and this happens quite regularly, is that the discharger itself can propose a SEP. So if they may be a public entity which has projects that are, you know, on the shelf that they're ready to deploy that go above and beyond their regulatory requirements and otherwise satisfy the requirements of our policy, or they may work with a third-party administrator to develop a project which they are interested in funding. And oftentimes in settlement, the discharger is bringing those to the table to us, and where possible, and in compliance with our policy, the prosecution team staff works closely with the discharger staff to get those SEPs into a position that they can be included in our settlement. The Office of Enforcement also maintains a list of SEPs and a SEP proposal form to work with third-party groups in order to develop projects which could be funded through enforcement actions. And then in your region, your staff works closely with the Rose Foundation to identify projects which are located in or benefit environmental justice or disadvantaged communities. And there's a list of SEPs through the Rose Foundation that are available, and staff frequently considers those and discusses them with parties it's engaged in settlement in. Next slide, please. So the State Water Board, like it has an enforcement policy, also has a policy on supplemental environmental projects, and it outlines a number of requirements that a SEP needs to meet in order to be included in a settlement agreement. I will not go through every single one of these in great detail, but I'll highlight a few of them here that I think are most important. The first being is that there needs to be a nexus to the alleged violation, meaning that not just any SEP is going to be available in any settlement. So there are two ways to satisfy the nexus requirement. The first is location, the other is violation type. So that's a finding that we usually don't struggle to meet, but it means that not every single project that might be on the Rose Foundation's list, for example, is going to be eligible for inclusion in every single settlement. The SEP policy also outlines detailed requirements as to what needs to be in a complete project proposal, timeline, reporting requirements, budgeting, et cetera. And a final completion date, and we'll talk more about kind of the timeline of that in a moment here. And then also the policy requires that the SEP have some sort of performance standard or indicators of success that need to be met in order for the liability to actually be dismissed. Next slide, please. So usually when we're engaged in settlement, we consider SEPs going up to 50% of the total liability. There are a few off-ramps to this general rule, the first being for mandatory minimum penalties. So this is a fairly narrow exception, but this is provided in statute for the first $15,000 in mandatory minimum penalties being allowed to go 100% towards a SEP. And then there are a number of exceptions which are outlined in the SEP policy. The first of those being scenarios where the director of the Office of Enforcement makes a finding of a compelling justification to exceed the 50% total liability. And I think that those circumstances are quite rare, but what we encounter very regularly is the second bullet point here, which is where SEPs are located in or benefit disadvantaged or environmental justice communities. And in fact, there is a standing exception to the 50% cap for those policies, and we just provide notification to the director of OE that we're going to include a SEP that falls within that category, and then we can exceed the 50% limit. For your region, the Rose Foundation SEPs I've been alluding to generally fall within this category of projects which may exceed the 50% limit. Next slide. Okay, timeline. Kaylin mentioned that part of the timeline in settlement is related to development of SEPs, and I think that's certainly true, but then there's separate timeline requirements for the projects as they're developed, which is that generally SEPs need to be completed within 36 months of the adoption of the stipulated order. This is a tight timeline, especially depending on the kind of project that's being considered. And so sometimes we will seek an exception to this 36-month limit, and the policy allows for us to go up to 48 months based on a finding of exceptional environmental benefit. Most of our settlement agreements, I think in particular in your region this is the case, include language that allows the executive officer to grant an extension if there is a reasonable basis for why some sort of SEP deadline could not have been met. And that language is intended to allow the project to be completed as long as the discharger is making a good faith effort at complying with the order and recognition that some circumstances are outside of their control. Okay, next slide. I alluded to this just a moment ago, but the discharger is responsible for the administrative civil liability that it has settled as part of the stipulated order until the SEP is completed, which means that even if the discharger has selected a SEP which is going to be implemented by a third party, they don't get to just write the check and walk away without any accountability for that project actually being implemented and meeting its success criteria. So until those success criteria are demonstrated to have been met and a final report is submitted per the stipulated order, the discharger remains on the hook for that potential liability. Next slide. So separate from SEPs is something called an enhanced compliance action. And enhanced compliance actions are allowed by the enforcement policy for settlement of discretionary administrative civil liabilities only, meaning that for mandatory minimum penalties, these are not an option for dischargers. They are distinguishable from SEPs because they are capital or operational improvements which go back into the discharger's operations. They are required to be above and beyond those required by law and not just by Water Board's regulatory requirements, but including other regulatory requirements that discharger may be subject to in other arenas. And these, like SEPs, are only available as a term of settlement. So the board cannot adopt an order after a contested hearing, which includes an enhanced compliance action. This is only something that can be negotiated in the context of a settlement agreement. And in terms of reporting and timeline, those kind of more logistical requirements is subject to the SEP policy as well. Okay, and I'll pass it back to Kaylin. One more thing to go over before I pass it back to Kaylin is getting the proposed settlement approved. So once the parties have engaged in the negotiation process and come up with an agreement in principle and drafted a stipulated order, this slide is intended to just go over the kind of practical realities of getting that settlement across the finish line. So we are required for Clean Water Act violations to post our settlements for a 30-day public notice period. As a matter of practice, we generally post all of our settlement agreements, even if they're not specifically subject to this requirement. If we receive public comment during that period, the prosecution team usually responds to those comments or considers them to the extent that they feel it's appropriate. Prior to the settlement being presented to the advisory team, who works with the board and or the executive officer to have that settlement agreement adopted. And in your region, there is a delegation in place which allows the many of our settlements to be adopted by the executive officer, but to the extent that the board wants to be able to hear it in open session and make that consideration itself, that's always an option as well. And now I'm going to pass it back to Kaylin to talk about what happens when we're unable to reach a settlement agreement.
All right, so the third ACL pathway is for the prosecution team to issue an ACL complaint. So this can happen for a couple of reasons. It's either because we tried to reach a settlement and we're not able to do so, resulting in us needing to move forward with issuing the complaint, or we may issue the complaint prior to attempting to reach a settlement. And there's really two main reasons that we would do so. Either having to do with a timing issue of the violations could be almost subject to latches, and we want to avoid that argument, and latches is somewhat similar to a statute of limitations. Or it could be an issue that's really important to the public, and we want to be transparent about what our violations are and what we're thinking in terms of a proposed penalty. Because as we mentioned, settlements can take time, and it may not be responsible for us to be having negotiations for months on a high profile public issue. So we issue the complaint. What's in the complaint is that we'll allege who the dischargers are, the violations, and the penalty amount. And that penalty amount will be based on the 10 steps in the penalty methodology and the enforcement policy. And it's important to note that issuance of this complaint does not preclude settlement. We could still settle the case at any point up until the date of hearing. And that's often what happens. As you may have noticed, you have not had a hearing before your board in a very long time. I have been with the water boards for about 10 years, and I don't believe a case has actually made it to your board in that time. So your staff is very effective at obtaining settlements. But if we'll go to the next slide, if there were to be a hearing before your board, it would be governed by a set of hearing procedures that contain deadlines, evidentiary submittal requirements, and describe the conduct of the contested evidentiary hearing. And these hearings are usually scheduled during a regular board meeting. But if it requires more time, it could be scheduled for a separate day or multiple days, just depending on the nature of the case. At this hearing, the board is the decision maker, as Catherine mentioned earlier. And again, unfortunately, you're not able to incorporate SEPs or ECAs at the hearing. All right, next slide. There is a different type of hearing, which is hearings before the executive officer. And these are limited in scope primarily to mandatory minimum penalty cases. The process is still the same. It's a contested evidentiary hearing. There are hearing procedures. The main difference is that the executive officer will be the decision maker instead of the board. So the board would not be involved in these type of cases. Next slide. Which is our last topic, which is referral to the Attorney General's office. And historically, referrals for civil liability cases have been pretty rare. But there may be instances where it's appropriate to do so. And most of this time, it has to do with other state agencies, such as the Department of Fish and Wildlife, also referring the same discharger or case to the Attorney General's office. We want to share resources, work cooperatively with the goal of reaching a global settlement. We may also be seeking injunctive relief for the court, meaning that we want the court to require the discharger to do something, such as comply with a cleanup and abatement order, which is something that your board does not have the ability to grant or issue that type of injunctive relief. And then lastly, there could be some resource constraints with your staff or attorneys, or you'd want to utilize investigative tools or resources that the Attorney General's office has, but the water boards do not. Once the case is referred to the AG's office, the board itself becomes the client, and you'll be able to direct the case moving forward. So that concludes our overview, and I will direct any questions to our Assistant Chief Counsel, David Boyers. Thank you.
Thanks very much. I'm sure we have questions. So perhaps we'll start with Board Member Mendez.
Great. Thank you for that very informative overview. I look forward, if we can also get a copy of the PowerPoint, that'd be helpful, email to us. I had three questions. The first is regarding the SEP and the confidential settlement process, where you mentioned the board cannot direct that this be implemented part of the settlement that is optional for the entity to decide if they want to include that settlement agreement. But there's a process in which the board can ask for more information and where they can state additional findings that may be needed. So in that process, where does the step come in? When you ask about more information in general, I'm sure that it beyond the step, but could you also ask for if they've considered a step and why or why not? Things like that.
Good morning. Let me make sure I understand your question. Are you asking when is it appropriate for the board to say we would like more information about what was discussed?
Yes. Okay. And then part of that, can one of the questions be on why or why not was a step considered?
When you say a step, are you talking about the penalty methodology, 10-step methodology?
For the settlement agreement, where it's optional.
No, you mean the SEP.
SEP. So I'm sorry.
In other words, I think the board member is asking, when the settlement is brought to the board and a particular SEP is part of that settlement that's been arrived at, can the board say, well, why this particular SEP? Why did you go to the Rose Foundation on this one? Why not this other?
Or vice versa, if they're not proposing it,
yes.
Can we ask them to provide explanation of why they did not propose a SEP?
Absolutely, you can and you do, and other boards do the same. Generally, you ask those questions when the settlement is before you. Mm-hmm. We, as we've discussed, we engage in a lengthy process to try to resolve ACL cases through settlement, and during that process, we often, in most cases, discuss the option of SEPs. And as Kaylin discussed, it's up to the discharger to agree to that. We can't mm-hmm. force them to do that. And some dischargers in settlement say we don't want to be responsible for a SEP. We don't want to be on the hook for 3 years. We want to pay and be done. Mm-hmm. And so we'll take that, and if they're unwilling to do a SEP, then our settlement may not include one. And we'll bring that before you, and you can ask the question, hey, why didn't you include a SEP?
Okay.
And we will say, oh, the discharger, would you like to respond to that? And maybe they will and maybe they won't, mm-hmm. right, because those discussions are confidential. There may be reasons why they don't want to do a SEP beyond just the, you know, not being responsible for the liability.
And currently, if they choose to forgo the SEP, and pay the penalty, what is the breakdown of the penalty of it going to the state and then staying within the local jurisdiction, the regional board, that is?
Yeah, if they opt not to do a SEP, then the entire liability amount is deposited into either the cleanup and abatement account or the waste discharge permit fund, depending mm-hmm. on what the violation is and where the statute directs that money to go.
And my recollection, we currently do not have any policy of that being funneled back to the regional district that experienced
Well, so there's not an automatic funnel for the money to come back. There is an application process for regional boards and other agencies to apply for money based on need. If there's an urgent cleanup and abatement project where there's not a viable responsible party, there is statutory authority for you to make a request and say, hey, you know, we want $1 million to be set aside or given to us as a grant so we can then fund this cleanup. I would say, you know, I'm not an expert in the cleanup and abatement account. About $11 million on average gets deposited into that account every year. Mm-hmm. I know for the last 5 years or so, the State Water Board has really focused on drinking water projects, mm-hmm. And a lot of good work has come from that money to support drinking water projects.
Statewide,
mm-hmm. correct. And there are regions that have asked for money for specific cleanup work.
Okay, thank you. I guess I can ask that question more next week at the WCCC. And the two last questions is, I didn't understand quite the difference between the ECA and the SEP. Can you explain a little bit more about what the ECA is?
Yeah, an enhanced compliance action is an improvement to the discharger's system. Let's say they're a wastewater system and they're operating their collection system. It's a capital or improvement project that they undertake that doesn't necessarily have a public benefit at large, but goes above and beyond what their obligations are to essentially enhance their ability to comply with the permit. One example that I give is smart manhole covers has been used in other cases. It's not required under the general SSS WDRs, but it can facilitate more timely response to SSOs. Mm-hmm. And so we have given credit, or I should say offset liability, so folks can implement that type of project as an enhanced compliance action. And a SEP is different in that it's a benefit to the public at large. There's a general water quality benefit, and there's the nexus requirement and all the other issues that were discussed today.
And then when you decide about those projects for the ECA, is it based on some type of criteria that would be more beneficial in upgrading their infrastructure versus others?
I mean, it depends on what the discharger wants to do and what we're willing to accept in a settlement.
Okay. And then the last question about is the executive officer hearings. And for the sort of the minimum mandatory, is it penalties, right? How often has that occurred within, I guess, the last couple of years? Or has our EO had any chance to preside over that yet?
Let Russ answer that.
So, no. Susanna has not had that opportunity. And several years ago, I mean, you know, 2008, we had a number of executive officer hearings. The mandatory minimum penalty law was relatively new. People were trying to understand, the dischargers were trying to understand the process, so a lot of them went straight to an EO hearing. Mm-hmm. We anticipate an EO hearings coming up in the near future, mm-hmm. So you will hear about those.
And then I guess putting my urban planner hat, it seems similar to like a zoning administrator hearing, kind of. Sort of, okay.
I don't know about administrative hearings, but yeah. It sounds similar.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
It's through the delegate. You have delegated authority, mm-hmm. to the executive officer to hear certain types of cases up to a certain penalty amount. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I have a few questions. You had also stated in the presentation that the compressed ACL is a public document. And so as a public document, is this subject to public comment and responses to comment? Or because it's a compressed, that it really doesn't go through that?
No, it does go through the public comment process, okay. Assuming it results in a settlement. So if the discharger says, this looks great to me, I'm going to sign it, we will actually notice that for a 30-day comment period, take comments as we do with any other settlement, and then assuming no comments warrant change, it will be presented to your executive officer for signature.
Okay, thank you. And one more question I have is that you also stated that the dischargers do retain liability until the SEP is fully completed, even if the third-party entity is responsible for completing it. So what happens if the SEP is not completed and, I guess, full completion to get to the results that are intended takes more than the 50% of the budget that your cap for the SEP. Is the discharger still liable to complete this to the end?
Absolutely. That's a risk that the discharger takes. We find often that the discharger will have a separate contract with any third-party administrators, that if they fail to finish the SEP, they'll be responsible. They'll indemnify us. But ultimately, our case is against the discharger, and that's who we have sign off on. Ultimately, the finishing the SEP and making sure that it's funded, and if it's not, we have that ability to go after them.
Okay, thank you very much.
Board member Christensen, anything from that? Okay. Do you have anything?
I don't have any questions. I just wanted to thank Kaylin and Catherine. This was a really helpful presentation. I operated in a similar space doing environmental protection work at a district attorney's office, working with the AG's office with a lot of SEPs, but there's a lot of differences in this work, and so it was really informative for all of us as well as for the public. So thank you. Thanks for your time.
Thanks very much. I've got a couple of questions, and thank you all so much for your service to the board. I know we count on you a lot, and we see you on the screen quite often, but thank you very much. It's truly, truly appreciated. So, I think we understand that when a settlement is brought to us, we're in the position of judges, right? We're a court with all of the evidentiary issues that go with that, and I understand 1152 and 1154, we deal with that, all the time. But I think that if and when it does come to us at that point, we're in a public forum, and I think at that point that's where the insufficient information question comes into play. So I would hope that at that point we would be able to ask those kinds of questions and get responses. But I think the main issue is what is it that has to come to us, and what is it that in the meantime we can ask? So I know that we have the delegation of authority that you referred to. I think I would like to know what that delegation of authority is, what is the dollar amount, and what are the kinds of cases, because it happens from time to time that we hear of a settlement that's occurred, and as board members, we had no idea. So I don't know whether it's possible during that process for the board to get even perhaps in the litigation subcommittee in a closed session, some kind of maybe not an update of the details of it, but that there is a settlement that's being discussed as to some kind of issue. So I would like us to weigh that a little bit so that we can understand what questions we're able to ask, as the settlement is going forward, so that because we're kind of out in the public, and people will say things to us like, oh, it's nice that you reached a settlement on such and such a thing, and we won't have even, we won't have known about it. But I think for us to know just what is it that we've delegated, what are the kinds of things that you're deciding upon, I think that would be very helpful. That's a matter of policy of the board. We should take a look at that.
Do you mind if I interject here? The amount for the delegations are in the delegation order from the board to the EO. Currently, right now, if the complaint has a dollar amount less than $50,000 and a potential maximum liability less than $100,000, that can be reviewed and approved by the EO without consultation with the board. But if it exceeds those amounts, then we consult with the chair to determine whether it's a matter of sufficient controversy that it should go to the board. And so we haven't done one of those with you, but we have a few that we'll talk with you about. And so I don't know that we're always, I believe the settlements get updated in the EO report, but maybe we could do a better job flagging when they happen.
Yeah. So here's the kind of balancing act that we need to think about. Because in terms of negotiating with the discharger, it's very useful to be able to say, you know what, I can settle this for this amount. If this is not agreeable to you, this is going to have to go to the board with all of the exposure that involves. And I think to a discharger, it would be very attractive to do that. And it's very attractive from the point of view that of resources and all kinds of brain damage and so on and so forth. On the other hand, it may be that $50,000 these days is way too little for the kind of affront to the environment that may have been caused. So I think at some point we need to decide on a kind of policy level. Are those numbers right? But I think we also very much need to be cognizant of the fact that we want you to have the flexibility to reach settlements quickly, get them done, you know, and move forward. That's not a conversation for this forum right now, but I think we need to be aware of the dynamics that go into that negotiation as we go forward. So, anyway, I'll go ahead. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and that kind of reminds me of just this whole idea of the separation between the advisory team and the prosecution team, because I know in the presentations it was said that sometimes the firewall is going up and the advisory team may or may not know. And so, you know, in the case that maybe perhaps the advisory team or the board members do not know, you may inadvertently get thrown in or yeah. exposed. And so, you know, to the case, you know, because we have connections out with the community, et cetera. So if there is some kind of way to definitively say the firewall's up and still, you know, maintain a solid firewall, that would be, you know, appreciated as well, both internal within staff and also to the board.
Yeah, that would mean that there would have to be a communication that some settlement process is in progress. But then that would mean some kind of disclosure that there has been at least an alleged violation and so on. Yeah, I don't know whether we can settle all of this here, but I think we do need to have a discussion about the levels, about making sure that you have the flexibility to do your work, while at the same time making sure that things don't get settled for an amount less than there should be, you know, because the delegation of authority is that level. But at the same time, making sure that the board members have some level of information so that one is not kind of, you know, blindsided, if you like, in all of the public kind of engagements that we have as board members. Any more on that? Any more?
Nope.
Vice Chair? No? Okay. All right. Well, with that, we will thank you very, very much for a really comprehensive presentation that was greatly appreciated and which has posed more questions to be answered in the future. Thanks a lot. Thank you. Okay. That is the end of that. Do we have any speakers remotely that want to react in any way to the presentation we just received? No? Okay. Any comments from any board members? Any further comments? Okay. So I think we will ask our legal counsel to announce any items that we have for closed session, or are we going to have a closed session today?
There's no closed session today.
Okay, so there's no closed session today. And that will, I think, conclude our business for the day. I don't need a motion for adjournment, do I? Okay. All right, with that, we are adjourned. Thank you all so much.
Thank you, Chair. And just a reminder, our next board meeting will be May 22nd.
Yes. May 22nd, right here.
Thank you.